For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week we're going travelling. Jason Roberts introduces us to James Holman, the blind traveller who journeyed around the world.
Moved through the world as his life depended on it, and in many ways it seemed like it did.
Jasper Wynne takes us on a journey around Ireland by canoe.
Kayaking around Ireland, which is 1,000 miles, if you miss most of Ireland out, you go point to point, was probably the first thing I've ever done which had a very simple mission statement: get back to where I started from.
Historian John Key describes some eccentric travellers.
Here's a man who's totally blind, who spent most of his life writing travel books.
And Chris McMillan talks about sight loss in China and the importance of literacy. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Until the invention of the internal combustion engine made long-distance travel easy, James Holman was the most widely travelled man in human history. Between 1819 and 1850, he journeyed around the globe, an estimated 250,000 miles, and visited every inhabited continent. That in itself was an astounding achievement. But to top it all, Holman did it alone, on a shoestring budget, and he was blind. But his fame was short-lived and his story forgotten until writer Jason Roberts stumbled across it. Jason Roberts, welcome to RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.
So, for those who don't already know, who was James Holman?
Everyone should know who James Holman was. James Holman was one of the most famous people of the Victorian era, who has become almost completely forgotten. He was born in 1786, died in 1857, and in that period of time, he actually became the most well-traveled person in the world, as far as we can calculate from the records that were left behind. And what makes that achievement, which is itself impressive, even more impressive, is the fact that he did that while being completely blind.
And also from your book, on a shoestring budget and alone for most of the time.
Yes, that's true. He really wasn't just someone who was idly on some kind of extended vacation. He insisted on traveling alone. He entered pretty much every country knowing not a single word of the local language. He had almost no money, which forced him to travel as close to the ground and as close to the native culture as possible, which itself was quite an unusual thing to be doing in the early 1800s. But yeah, pretty much, Red, you have you're the one that I think came up with the characterization of him as the most restless man in human history. And I actually think that's a very appropriate term for it, because he wasn't just a professional traveler. He was incredibly restless. He moved through the world as if his life depended on it, and in many ways it seemed like it did.
Well, you start the book with him on the slopes of Mount Vesuvius, determined to get to the summit, despite the fact that it's in mid-eruption. And he is tapping his way, in a way that's so familiar to those of us who use a cane, up the side of the mountain, whilst sighted people are urging him to turn back. It's a very arresting image, and I think that characterised his travels for the rest of his life, didn't it?
It seems to have done so, yes. People were asking him to turn back, and he did so reluctantly, simply because it was, in fact, the middle of the night, and the lack of light was a handicap to his sighted partners, but it was not to him. And at that particular time, he quipped, "I see things better with my feet," which is a really interesting approach to life, because he did, in fact, seem to view every single day as a kind of a puzzle. He wanted to look out into the world as a series of perpetual confrontations with the unknown. And that was to me, was very surprising about James Holman. Not only that when I was tracing his travels, I found that he traveled more than anybody else of the era, but also he seemed to go out of his way to make sure that he would never cross his own path. And he always made sure that although people would want to help him and help him along, and he would make good long-lasting friendships, he always insisted on venturing on alone and by himself. And that idea of intentionally embracing what is the inherent confusion of life for everyone, sighted or unsighted, was something that really brought him to life to me. And I realized this is a person whose voice needs to be returned to our everyday dialogue.
Yes, he was very determined to walk his own path. And that, as comes through in the book, is something that was virtually unique for blind people. One's prospect, if you were diagnosed with sight loss in the early 19th century, were pretty dire, weren't they?
They were indeed. The main source of income for sightless people was, in fact, either begging or running a hurdy-gurdy, which one of those crank music machines, or allowing yourself to be rented out as an object of fun at county fairs, that sort of thing. It was I was quite surprised to understand that it was quite an attraction to round up blind people, place them on a stage, give them directions, and laugh at the ensuing chaos. The idea that a sighted person was somehow entitled to dignity just didn't exist. And in fact, particularly in the case of someone like James Holman, who lost his eyesight at the age of 25, there was the stigma that I was not quite aware of, which is that the leading cause of blindness among men at that age, at that time, was in fact syphilis. So one of the things that he had to do, in fact, was provide proof that his blindness was not the result of, quote, moral turpitude, so on and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that if you saw a blind person ambling down the street, and it would be ambling at the time because there were no such things as guide dogs, and even the ritualized tapping of a cane was something that only a few blind people seemed to have improvised, including Holman, you would probably cower away from that person, thinking that they were some kind of diseased individual, but at the very least you would start laughing.
And Holman certainly didn't take his diagnosis lying down. Amazingly, he qualified as a doctor, one supposes, in the hope that he might be able to find a cure, or at least an explanation.
Yeah, that's true. He was also, as far as we can tell, the first blind person to study medicine at the University of Edinburgh, which then as now was one of the most prestigious medical schools in the world. You would think that the historical record would be replete with stories of this amazing person who had somehow qualified for medical school, but it turns out that the medical education system was pretty much inverted at that time, and you were quite allowed to just show up and take as many lectures as you wanted. And the vast majority of people who finished their medical education didn't bother to get their medical license because it was a cost of an extra £15 or something like that. And James Holman did, in fact, take enough classes that would have qualified him to set up shop as a doctor. He, however, did not do that. And this is one of the heartbreaking things that I realized, is that instead of doing that kind of thing, he simply started retaking some of the classes again. And the classes that he was studying in were ones that seemed to be focused on eyesight, restoring health. And it does seem to me that his attempt to go to medical school was an attempt to cure his own condition. His condition is still mysterious right now, but it does seem to have been a response to a kind of autoimmune disorder. Because what happened is that he was a naval ensign in the British Royal Navy, and he apparently contracted this autoimmune disease, a form of arthritis, essentially, from exposure to the cold weather. And it got so bad and so painful that he was invalided out of the Navy, and he was, in fact, recuperating at Bath. And then he found that the immune system took on this very surprising turn, and that not only was he still left in lifelong pain in his joints, but his eyesight began to fail, and eventually it was completely dark, and he remained blind for the rest of his life. So you had this person who was in a situation where he was not only debilitated by the loss of eyesight, but the very act of moving around was incredibly painful to him. It's very interesting that this is a person who you would think would have just been idled in a room somewhere, stuck up for the rest of his life as a charity case. The fact that he, in fact, overcame this and became one of the most active, one of the most moving people at a time when he was, like I said, not only blind, but in a great deal of physical pain, is just astonishing to me.
He certainly had the choice to idle away the rest of his days at St. George's Church, Windsor, as one of the seven knights, which would have just involved him going to church twice a day, but instead he chose to travel.
Yes, he was very, very fortunate. He was named a Naval Knight of Windsor, which was one of the few charities that were available to handicapped naval veterans at the time. A naval knight is not the same as a chivalric knight. He was not entitled to be referred to as Sir James or anything of that sort. But what the naval knights did is that they actually lived in Windsor Castle, and this was at a time when King George III was pretty much a permanent resident of the castle, and they were given a lifetime grant of care, which meant that they got room and board. It seemed like a very, very pushy arrangement for James Holman, but then he quickly came to realize that his obligation was that he was supposed to attend religious services in St. George's Chapel twice a day, every day, for the rest of his life. And that simply meant boringly climbing up the stairs into the castle itself and sitting through this tedious ceremony and offering up prayers for the royal family. And he realized that that was going to be his life stretched out before him. So what he did is he started to kind of redefine what the duties of the naval knight would be. And that's when he decided that he would take up a medical education. And then that ended up becoming a chain of adventures that he ended up fighting for the very right to undertake.
And his first two long journeys, firstly a tour of Europe and then extraordinarily an attempt to travel through Russia and round the world from the furthest point east back to Britain, were very successful, both in terms of the journeys themselves and also in terms of the books that came from them.
It is interesting that he ended up making something of a living as a fairly well-selling author of travel books. You would think that the idea of a blind person writing travel books would itself be the object of fun, and indeed it was, but he very cannily tried to address that. He'd be the first to poke fun at himself. And in the beginning of the books of these adventures, he would basically establish that, yes, I'm blind, but that actually allows me to be more authentic in writing about my experiences because he put it this way, I will not literally be a sightseer. I will not fall into the trap of simply seeing the sights of a place, meaning that a lot of people go traveling in order to have their own visual preconceptions confirmed. And it was a very interesting point that he made. He followed it through in some very interesting stories. He also would take no qualms about entertaining the reader, and he would point out about practical jokes that were played on him. So, for example, when he was at a gallery in Italy, and he was admiring the statues and being allowed to touch his hands on them, and a friend of his, a practical joker, took him to where a living model was posing, and he allowed him to put his hands on that. So there were things like that that he took a great deal of joy and pleasure in it. His hope was that people would acknowledge they was blind, and then within a few pages, they would forget about that. And that also seemed to be the case of his personality. When you would meet him, and there are just many, many accounts of people meeting him for maybe half an hour and then remembering him for the rest of their lives, he would immediately set people at ease. He would have insights toward them. He would make them feel comfortable, make them feel listened to, and people would, in fact, forget that he was blind.
He certainly comes across as an incredibly personable man who you would happily invite to your dinner table just to hear him talk and to share what comes across as actually rather a good sense of humour as well.
I would say that is the case. And the interesting thing is that humour is a way of reminding people of your humanity. We talk about that, the idea of humour, laughter being the universal language. And it was very fascinating that being able to be humorous himself, he was able to diffuse that previous notion of being laughed at. So people would like laugh with him or enjoy, you know, and be mirthful with him as opposed to laughing at him. I think the specter of blind people as being carnival sideshows was still very strong in his mind. So this is someone who was quite intelligently deconstructing tropes about blind people, about infirmity, and he seemed to be having a really, really good career of it, because his first two books were in fact bestsellers. He was allowed to dedicate them to the royal family, and as I said, he became known almost generically as just the blind traveler, and he began traveling with portraits of himself that he would autograph and signed to people, because he got so many requests to do so. He was known enough that at the time of his death in 1857, his entry in the Encyclopedia Britannica was, I think, a page and a half long. It was fairly well documented. And over the years, it got edited down more and more until it was one sentence. And then I think in about the 1920s, and the Encyclopedia Britannica just disappeared altogether. And that was fascinating for me to see not only this person in the historical record, but to watch him slowly disappear from it and to understand why that may have happened.
Partly you reveal that was through some jealousy, some remaining mistrust as to whether a blind man's perceptions were as valid as those of a sighted person, and also partly because he changed his style, didn't he, for the third book. I felt noticeably more visually descriptive, and also he starts taking hearsay rather than his own personal experience and writing it up in the book.
His third book was his most ambitious book, because it reflected his most ambitious effort, which was to fully circumnavigate the world. And so it was a large multi-volume book in which he attempted to be really exhaustive as possible. He took seriously the idea that he could in fact travel and emerge from the place with a body of documentation, shifting it from a severe personal narrative to something in which he is relying on other people's reports, is actually going closer to the mainstream of travel writing at that time. He did not rely on reportage any more or less than other people did at the time. It was simply more a matter of him letting go of the strength of his individual narrative and trying to be more authoritative. It was a natural next move for him to have. Unfortunately, you are correct that that then opened him up to an accusation that kind of crippled his career. And that was an attack by an enemy.
Yes, which eventually meant that, unfortunately, his magnum opus, what would have been his fourth book, never saw the light of day. And as you say, his star waned somewhat. I was fascinated to learn how he recorded his observations and his travels on something called a noctograph.
It's fascinating. This was an era before even Braille existed. So how was he able to document and produce his manuscripts? He ended up relying on a technology that was invented originally for spies and for soldiers who were trying to write notes in the dark under enemy lines. And that's what the nautograph means, and night writing ability. And it was essentially a wooden frame with a series of wires horizontally on it that were guidelines to allow somebody to write. But more importantly, what happened is that you were pressing down on what was called carbonated paper, and the impression would leave a dark mark, a dark grayish mark, which is not the same as ink. And if that sounds familiar to people, the nautograph has long since disappeared, but carbonated paper became known as carbon paper, and that was a mainstay of the business world for, of course, many, many years.
Yes, those of us who started our careers in journalism and writing three copies using carbonated paper remember it only too well.
Exactly. That, unfortunately, seemed to be a gap in historical record, because James Holman's original writings, to the modern eye, looked like they were carbon copies, and therefore they could easily be weeded and be thrown out, but they were in fact the originals. And that is something that seemed to have become the fate of some of his last works.
Now, as you say, even in his own lifetime, his star was in The Descendant, and by the end of the 19th century, he had faded into obscurity. How did you come across him?
The simple answer is I read about him in a book. The more nuanced answer is that I was simply idly wasting time in the halls of a library one day, which is in fact one of the most delicious ways to not waste time in the world, and I happened across a book that I picked up simply because it had an interestingly colored spine. It was a bright turquoise book for some reason, and that book was it was called Eccentric Travelers, and it was simply a series of short chapter-length biographies of people that were eccentric and would like to travel. And there was one on a person who was an amateur taxidermist who would make up fake species and claim that they came from the Amazon rainforest. There was someone who was, you know, a traveling, self-proclaimed prophet, this kind of thing. And so, you know, a bunch of fairly loony people. But then there was one chapter on the blind traveler, and that fascinated me. And I thought, well, first of all, being blind is not an eccentricity. He doesn't belong among this company. But it was so interesting that I simply went over to the biography aisle and looked under the H's for what I presume would be at least two or three biographies of this James Holman character. And there were no biographies. So I went to the reference desk and asked if they could order one. And there were none. And then I went to the University of California system and asked if there were any in their system. There were none. And I was able to find that by sheer accident, that one chapter on The Blind Traveler was in fact the only thing that had been published about James Holman in the entire 20th century. So at some point, the process of looking for the book became the process of writing the book.
A writer's dream. Now, I'm sure the next question you always get asked is, what is James Holman's legacy? But both you and I know that the legacy, due in no small part to your writing, A Sense of the World, is, in part, the Holman Prize. How did you come to be involved with the Holman Prize?
That is one of the signal honors of my life. I did not know any blind people when I began to write this book. In the process of researching it, I was astonished to find that many of the things that James Holman had discovered on his own over 150 years earlier were in fact being very gleefully rediscovered by the blind and visually impaired community. And I was very happy to be able to end with a profile of a blind activist in Southern California who actually is using echolocation techniques very similar to the ones that James Holman used. And actually fielding a team of mountain biking enthusiasts. The same ability, the same fresh approach to orienting oneself in the world that allowed James Holman to ride a horse flawlessly through the streets of Tasmania was allowing a new generation of people to gleefully ride their mountain bikes up and down the hills of Southern California. So I was very happy that I was able to connect that with ongoing research. And that brought me into the orbit of really some very interesting people. And very fortunately, some of those have been involved in the leadership of Lighthouse for the Blind. And when they asked me to serve as a judge, the only cited judge for their newly launched Holman Prize, that was simply something I could not turn down.
Well, it's a fantastic legacy, and you deserve to be there as the cited judge on that panel. I shall do my absolute best to live up to the example of James Holman. But Jason Roberts, thank you so much for not only all the hard work that you did in bringing James Holman back into the public consciousness, but also for giving up your morning to talk to me on Read On.
It's been my pleasure, Red. Thank you very much.
In an era where the blind were routinely warehoused in asylums, Holman could be found studying medicine in Edinburgh, fighting the slave trade in Africa, where the Holman River was named in his honour, hunting rogue elephants in Ceylon, and surviving a frozen captivity in Siberia. He helped unlock the puzzle of Equatorial Guinea's indigenous language, averting bloodshed in the process. In The Voyage of the Beagle, Charles Darwin cites him as an authority on the fauna of the Indian Ocean. In his commentary on the Arabian Nights, Sir Richard Francis Burton, who spent years following in Holman's footsteps, pays tribute to both the man and his fame by referring to him not by name, but simply as the Blind Traveller. James Holman was justly hailed as one of the greatest wonders of the world he so sagaciously explored. But astounding as his exploits were, a further astonishment is how quickly he was forgotten.
Jonathan Oliver narrating A Sense of the World. Jason Roberts's terrific biography of James Holman, A Sense of the World, How a Blind Man Became History's Greatest Traveller, is available in Braille and as TB15493. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we journey to China with historian John Key and speak to the founder of charity China Vision, Chris McMillan. But first, Jasper Wynne is a writer, photographer and broadcaster with a passion for adventure. He has canoed the length of the Danube, cycled across the Sahara, and traversed the Netherlands on roller skates. He's the author of Paddle, A Long Way Around Ireland, which charts his 1,000-mile circumnavigation of Ireland by sea kayak. It's a voyage of discovery that includes wild coastline, foul weather, encounters with basking sharks, and eccentric locals. Throughout it all, Jasper's resilience, comic ineptitude, and ability to fit in anywhere shine through. So, Jasper Wynne, welcome to Read On Air.
Great. Very good to be here. Really enjoying being here.
So, having read Paddle, I get the impression that you're the kind of man who cannot see a challenge and not want to do it.
You mean a river to kayak down, or a mountain to climb over, or a desert to cross? You're absolutely right. And then halfway across, I'll see something more interesting and get distracted and fail to get to the top of the mountain, or fail to get across the desert. And famously, I've just got distracted everywhere I've been. And kayaking around Ireland, which is 1,000 miles, if you miss most of Ireland out, you go point to point, point to point, was probably the first thing I've ever done which had a very simple mission statement: get back to where I started from.
It's a great book. I mean, you set out originally with your girlfriend at the time in fantastic weather, and within 4 days you're at death's door because of gallstones, and you have to give up the challenge for a year?
Yes, that was unexpected, and I feel really bad because I told Elizabeth, we'll stop if it's going to be miserable, if we don't have fun, if we think it's unsafe. So we went off, the two of us, in two kayaks. Secretly, I thought, if she gives up, I'll keep going. The rich irony of being in intensive care 4 days later and in and out of hospital for the next year. So when I set off a year later, it was the first time I'd been in a kayak for a year. And I've got this, I'm a slow adventurer. And so my philosophy is not to prepare too much, to let comic ineptitude drive the travel. And above all, not to tire yourself out before something by training, because you'll get fit on the way, obviously.
Absolutely. Yes, you weren't quite prepared for what the weather gods threw at you, though, were you?
I wasn't really well prepared at all, to be honest. I knew just enough about sea kayaking to be safe. Safe in the sense of I had unlimited time, and that was what was important. People who feel pushed to do something in a certain time, whether it's mountains, deserts, sea, rivers, are up against real challenges. I had ample time, and it was well, because I thought it might take me 35, 40 days. It ended up taking 3.5 months to get round, mostly because the weather was really bad that year. There was a pattern of jet stream that had moved down, very very changeable weather, so a lot of gales through the summer, 19 small craft warning days in a row in July. That means force 6 or over every day for 19 days. And wind is your real problem, wind, waves and swell when you're at sea. So my safety plan, very well worked out, was just to go to the pub until the weather got better. It meant that I spent, I really scared myself going around the south coast at the very beginning, long paddles from one headland to another. So the first big paddle was 14 miles across from Valentia Island to the end of the Dingle Peninsula. 14 miles at sea, you're 7 miles from land out in the middle. Except I was quite a lot further off land because I was being pushed out to sea towards America by the current and couldn't paddle fast enough to keep making real headway. And that's when I realised that I'd taken on a bit more of a challenge than I'd really anticipated. So I disappeared into Dick Mack's pub and became a musician for the next 3 weeks and laughed at people who went to sea. I think we're beginning to discover, as more and more people are windsurfing and sailboarding and sailing and sea kayaking particularly, how much wildlife there is out there. It's like a huge great safari park of whales, sunfish, basking sharks, blue shark. And to be part of that, to be in somebody, to be somebody else, into another species world, and to find they're at home there, dolphins and the turtles out there, seals, that's the reward. It suddenly means you're part of a wider world, and the paddling is just the way to get there.
I get the sense that, you know, being neither fish nor fowl, but being adequate on the water or on land gives you that sense of humility and a connection with the world about you.
Oh, Red, you put it so well. Neither fish nor fowl. When you're a kayaker, you are on the surface between these two different mediums, between the water, which is just, I find it awesome in the genuine sense of how much is below one. One looks down and on a clear day, you might be able to sense 20 foot down into the waters. But they can go hundreds, thousands of feet below you. There's all that stuff happening. And then the birds, which, and I'm a sort of keen, interested bird watcher, bird warrior, not a proper ornithologist, not a twitcher. I just love birds and what they do. I had a particular relationship with fulmars because they're a bit of an interloper. They've only moved down these parts quite recently in the last century. And so they're a bit sort of, they've got a bit of humility as well. They don't flock together like gannets and gulls. They tend to come by in pairs. And fulmars are just such beautiful birds, and they always come in. They're a bit sort of like cats. They just come in and just say hello. And I promise you, every time I pass a fulmar, I might be 3 or 4 miles offshore, they just dip a wing, they come over, and they just kind of do a little kind of flyby. Don't hang around, and off they go again. I got very superstitious about saying hello to fulmars, a bit like magpies on land. And I loved being in that precarious place, as you call it, between fish and fowl. And that's what a kayak, human-powered, very simple. I mean, a kayak is really nothing more than a sort of a coffin you sit up in. Takes you out into that world. And animals, seals, dolphins, basking sharks, seem to either ignore it or accept it as some strange form of badly designed turtle.
Now, there is a... You mentioned sharks, and there is an incident where you are being followed by a fin, much to the upset of people who were watching you from the coast. Were you scared, or did you know that it was a basking shark that was following you?
I had quite a number of incidents. Basking sharks are huge. I mean, I think 3 tons. You know, all those wonderful statistics, like they can filter an Olympic swimming pool of water in an hour of swimming and so forth. They are massive, but they're, of course, they're plankton feeders. But it was a year when there was a lot of sightings of great white shark off the coast of Britain and of Ireland. Some of them were hoaxes, some of them were fakes, but it was a bit of a kind of a story going around that year. You've got to ask yourself, if you wanted to get a picture of a great white shark and sell it for thousands to the media doing shark things, what are the chances of doing it in a small kayak in thousands and thousands of square miles of ocean? Possibly quite high, because I was off the Mayo coast in very difficult weather. It was weather I had to... You don't really concentrate, you just have to be fully aware. And I looked around and there was a fin, as you say, following me. And I thought, it's a dolphin. Now, we have a lovely relationship with dolphins. You know, dolphins are always in mythology, rescuing people and coming along and dancing around. There was Flipper when I was a kid. I looked around and I saw the fin. I was like, it's a dolphin, quite a large dolphin. Then I suddenly saw, heart-stoppingly, there was also a second fin, a tail fin, upright behind. Now, dolphins, and you know, have flattened flukes with their mammals. Sharks have an upright tail fin. And I was being followed by a large shark. And I thought, okay, basking shark. And I realised it was so close, I could see that it wasn't. It had a rounded nose. And I still don't know what it was. The most likely thing was it was a poor beagle shark. It was not much smaller than the length of the boat, which is sort of around about, the boat's 16 foot long. It was absolutely wonderful. I thought, if I can get a picture of this following me during shark hysteria, this whole trip is paid for. I am a coward. I did not take my hands off the paddle, twist round and take a picture of that shark. I thought, I'm just going to stay upright in this situation. But what it did, it was like being followed by a lion in the veld, but realising you're not in real danger unless you do something really silly. And I tried not to do anything really silly. What it did tell me was how much big stuff is out there. It is like the Serengeti for marine life off the coast of Europe. It's not just Ireland. Ireland's good for it, but it's all over the place. And that was what I really took back from the trip at the end, was how much wilderness there is out at sea, real wilderness.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Chris McMillan on blindness in China. But before that, earlier we heard Jason Roberts say that he was inspired to write about the blind traveller James Holman after reading a chapter in a book about him. That book was Eccentric Travellers, whose author John Key is a prolific and highly respected historian who's documented Britain's colonial past and made it accessible to all. With another of his books entering the RNIB library, he joined Robert Kirkwood to discuss some of the interesting stories he's turned up along the way.
Now, China is a massive country. Was it quite an undertaking to put an entire history in one volume?
Yes, I mean, it's an incredibly long history. China has probably one of the longest histories in the world. It's certainly 5,000 years, and to write a 5,000-year history in one volume is a bit of a challenge. But I was fortunate in that I'd done something very similar similar history of India about 10 years previously, and so I sort of knew the problems of writing a comprehensive history of a long, long period in one volume, and I sort of had ideas about how to approach it. So it wasn't quite as intimidating as it might have been.
And history is very important to the Chinese people, and adventure much more important than to us in the West.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, China is one of the few countries in the world that really defines itself not by its kind of geography, its terrain, or even by its people, but particularly by its history, by its past. And every dynasty and every regime that China has ever had has always looked back to the past to justify, to legitimize itself. And so history is incredibly important, and the Chinese probably have the longest tradition of history writing of any people in the world. So there's an immense amount of it. It's, again, contrasting it with India, you know, there's really hardly a date in Indian history before about 1000 AD, which is certain, and there are practically no written histories prior to that sort of period, the Islamic period. In China, it's completely the opposite. There are written histories from way back, from 200 or 300 years BC, and they look back to an even longer tradition. So there's absolutely masses of documentation.
Even today, with the People's Republic, they seem to politically have a very long-term view, which is rather opposed to our four-year or five-year government.
Yes, well, I think if you've got this long tradition of history behind you, you do tend to work in longer sort of time segments than we do, less short-termism. But particularly in terms of economics, I mean, it's not just that China has a vast history, but it is such a vast country that, you know, it's like turning it around. It's like turning around a large passenger liner or something. It takes a long time. And so they do tend to take a longer view of things and are prepared to put up with more in the short term than we would. Mm. Also, of course, not being subject to frequent elections like we are. The governments and regimes are not so accountable to the mass of the people.
Which isn't always a good thing, though.
No, of course not.
Now, you have been on the show before. At least one of your books has, with eccentric travellers. Now, forgive me, you may have written this a long time ago, but do you remember much about the traveller James Holman?
Yes, indeed. He was a blind traveller, a very unusual story, really. I mean, here's a man who's totally blind, who spent most of his life writing travel books, and he travelled all over the world. I can't remember the dates offhand. I think it was late 19th century. And he was famous as a blind traveller, and you would think that travel writing wasn't really the obvious choice for a person who couldn't see where he was going and needed a lot of assistance and so on. But actually, Holman was a brilliant travel writer. He managed to capture the essence of places and people and so on much more successfully than a lot of sighted travellers. And he was a great celebrity in his day, and he went all over the place. I mean, he went all over Russia, all over Africa, an incredible man. But as you say, it's sometimes as I've written about it.
Yeah, Eccentric Travellers has been on the show before, and it's just a wonderful read. The naturalist who wrestled boa constrictors, and the evangelist who went through the Hindu Kush naked, China, a history, and Eccentric Travellers are available as RNIB Talking Books, and all of John Key's books are available wherever books are sold. John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Like John Key, Chris McMillan is an expert on China. She's the co-founder of China Vision, a charity dedicated to supporting the rights of people with disabilities. China has one of the largest populations of blind people in the world. And Chris, who's sight-impaired herself, is passionate about literacy. But I began by asking her how the charity came about.
China Vision came out of a meeting out of the blue, where I went to listen to a lecture given by a blind person from China, and he had the idea that he could raise money for educating children in their home villages when they were blind, rather than having to send them away to school. He could raise the money, that was no problem, but he couldn't get the equipment. And so that's how China Vision's idea was born.
And China has one of the biggest populations of blind and visually impaired people in the world, doesn't it?
Oh, it's horrendous. Yes, it's millions. It changes every time I look at it, and I don't do big figures. The education system is still very much rooted in specialist schools, or a few won't be educated at all. And when you come to multiple disabilities, they still are in the world of possibly not getting an education. There are moves to get you into mainstream school, but the system of teaching doesn't lend it to that system yet.
So life for blind people in China is pretty miserable then, is it?
It certainly is if you're outside the east of the country or the big cities, perhaps. The further away you are from civilization, yes, the harder it's going to get. What is more noticeable is that they're still rooted in the idea that only one career is for blind people, or maybe two or three. But if you look, you will find massage, massage, massage. And actually, even those who have the jobs of their dreams, or they've managed to persuade somebody they could do a job and they pass the medicals for it, they still go and get a massage qualification because that's the kudos for them. Needless to say, most of ours do not do massage as their first job. In fact, none of them do, to my knowledge.
So what alternatives are you actually offering them?
Well, what we do, you have to work with a partner in China. You don't go in on your own accord and just do. So you have to find what you would like to do, and you have to find somebody in China prepared to do it with you, if you like. And the very first thing we did was to start bringing gifted people to Britain and teaching them Western skills. So they were speaking some English and they read very well. So they had a good grasp of British Braille, but they needed to learn how to speak. So when they came, we started to teach them how to use a knife and fork, as basic as that. And we were lucky then we could use education for the blind facilities and have people stay for 6 weeks, 3 months. And we could just about manage translation at that point. That, unfortunately, all fell apart come SARS and the 9/11. And after a little while, two or three years, we couldn't think how to get ourselves back on track. And then we realised that because quite a few of my trustees actually live or work in China, we could go to China. And the Olympics were coming. So our first project was actually to work with people who run a radio station. They were all blind, except for one person who had one leg. And that was our first big project. And, well, we haven't stopped since then, basically. But we're very proud of our radio colleagues in Beijing. And they did the Chinese Paralympics coverage. So that was 2008. And I think we'd started working with them in 2007. And since then, we've done an e-newsletter. We were at one point able to help in mobile advice clinics. So we do like we do here, handing out leaflets, only we used cassette tapes in those days. Much of it is very much what China will allow you to do, I have to say, and we're in a state of flux at the moment. The other thing we've done, the original radio station has the franchise for all programs on disability throughout China. And so we've changed ourselves slightly so that we say we support all forms of disability. And our big push now is to work with people with intellectual disabilities, particularly at the kindergarten level, because we've looked at employment, we've looked at education. We're now working seriously with children of, I think they're probably 5 or 6, because they start school later in China. And that's really exciting. And two of our trustees have written a book on the subject, which we hope to have in our hands in May, but it's being published in China, so I'm not holding out too much hope. This is what gets me out of bed every morning. Really, it's half my life, perhaps. A bit more, my husband might say.
And presumably that book will be in all accessible formats.
Well, no. It's been written for the Chinese market. It is being translated into English elsewhere. I think it's going to be available via the internet in China. But we haven't worked it all out yet. It all has to be funded, of course. But it is best practice in education or in life in general throughout the world. And our two trustees interviewed people in different countries. And it's little snapshots of their life. It is an academic book, but very readable. And I haven't seen the whole book yet, obviously, because it's in Chinese. But I've seen chunks in English. And I'm looking forward to getting my hands on an English copy when they're printed. It's being translated at the moment.
Well, let's hope that goes into the RNIB library as well.
Yeah, maybe in 2 or 3 years when we get down the line, yeah.
What are literacy levels amongst blind and visually impaired people in China like?
Some of them are fabulous. I mean, their use of technology is second to none. That China produces a lot of its own, but they do use Apple particularly and Microsoft, but they actually have people who believe in them and have written their own programs. So sometimes they seem very good, but I think that this is in the hands of the minority. But it's hard to get Chinese people to talk, which I understand from their history. And usually you're talking over the telephone or, as I do, FaceTime every week. So you don't get a true picture of almost anything, basically, unless you're living there, perhaps.
Now, you yourself have a visual impairment and have done since a very young age.
I was born with nystagmus, and unusually, it was picked up almost immediately because they thought I'd got retinopathy of prematurity. Basically, I was born very tiny, and they rushed me off to the incubator and hoped I was going to live. In fact, they don't know how heavy I was, but somewhere under 3 pounds, which in 1951, yeah, was a death sentence.
And what's that meant for your sight? You can still read?
Now, when I was younger, I could read anything you cared to give me because the print was actually well printed. The old-fashioned printing suited me. 2010, I had cataract surgery and they did a fabulous job on my distance vision. My distance vision is actually very good, which means under the medical model of disability, I do brilliantly. Which doesn't do you any favours in today's world. So on the social model, it's very hard to prove without showing personally how I struggle. So today, I need to read large print. I can type at 20 point, and I prefer to read at 24 point. Although I can read a newspaper, but I don't like it. I don't enjoy it the way I used to. So my preferred reading format is actually the Kindle, because if I lay my hands on a print book I want to read, it could be printed from a computer printout. And the print is very faint, and I just don't get on very well with whatever the font face is.
And do you access talking books and audiobooks at all?
I don't like being read to. I really don't. I never have done. I'm a bit of a dreamer, this is the problem. So I'm better having things in my paw. What will happen when I can't hold a Kindle or can't see well enough to read Kindle, I do not know. I can read Braille, but it's very, very slow. It's painful. And you can get to a stage where you have to spell out things to yourself a lot. And I haven't got to grips with the UEB standards at all. I can write, but I don't write that much now, really, because basically we've all got free phone calls or we've got computers, and my Braille has taken a bit of a back seat. Particularly, I don't need to write to people in China because they've now got access to Skype and FaceTime, and they'd love it even more if I used WeChat or QQ or whatever they'd like me to use.
Is there a Chinese version of Braille?
Yes, indeed there is. In fact, there are several types. It all goes back to the Western missionary, I have to say. Not just Braille, but William Moon as well. He went to China and he took his Moon script with him. There's a Mandarin form of Braille, which everybody uses now. When we had Hong Kong as a British territory, they used the Cantonese form of Braille, and that is still very much alive and well, because obviously people who live abroad who come from Hong Kong will be reading Cantonese Braille. There's a wonderful book called the World Braille Usage Guide, which I think has been issued twice, once in hard copy and now it's on the internet. So you have Cantonese, you have Mandarin, and of course the people that live in other parts of the world who speak Chinese, they would use one or other of theirs if they wanted to. There's also a Taiwanese form of Braille. and Tibetan. Well, that actually moves me to one of the things you want to know, which was my favourite book.
Ah, please tell me more.
Well, the author is Heinrich Harrer, who did climb in the Alps. And the book itself is called 7 Years in Tibet. And I know you're thinking that's a recent film. But the book itself was published in 1952, and I was at boarding school. I was at a school called Exor Grange, which lots of visually impaired people will know about. Well, I was there in the 1960s, and in 1968, our geography teacher then, Miss Haywood, known to all as Beza, out of the blue told us to get a book out of the bookshelves in her classroom. We never touched these books, never, and I think this was my year before I did my O-levels. And she told us to choose them, and we would have to write an essay. She was going to be away for a lesson, and our teachers were never away. Well, this terrified me because I didn't do very well with geography. And I went through this two shelves, and I couldn't find anything I liked. And I was a bookworm. And then she got a bit snappy. Come on, hurry up, you lot. So I grabbed the first one I could see that was a paperback because it didn't look as daunting. And it was 7 Years in Tibet. And it's such an easy book to read. And I was hooked. In fact, I was so hooked. I was looking up China and Tibet in our school atlases because I got enough sight to look at an atlas in those days with a hand lens without any problems. So that was my first book. And I have been hooked on China, Tibet, and coinciding with the fact that my dad adored mountains.
Well, Chris McMillan, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, Red.
By the end of August 1939, we had completed our reconnaissance. We had actually found a new way up the mountain and were now waiting in Karachi for the freighter which was to take us back to Europe. Our ship was long overdue, and the war clouds were growing ever denser. Chicken, Lobenhofer and I accordingly made up our minds to extricate ourselves from the net which the secret police had already begun to lay for us and to slip away wherever we found an opening.
7 Years in Tibet, written by Heinrich Harrer and narrated by Eric Gillette, is TB 289. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.